Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Hey, thank you for joining us at the Smart Family Podcast. If you have kids at home, I think you're going to love this episode because Jennifer Colari is the expert who joins us today. And she talks about what do you do when your kid's having a meltdown? You know, those situations are tough, aren't they, Rob?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's not just that situation. She talks about a technique called connected parenting, which is really relevant to all aspects of how we connect with our kids and even each other as parents. So, you know, I found out about her when I was talking with a team of therapists who I work with quite closely as part of my practice. And they were all talking about, hey, you gotta listen to Jennifer Colari on connected parenting. And sure enough, I did. And I read her book and I was like, wow, I love the stuff that she is teaching. We got to get her for the Smart Family Podcast. And so I reached out and I was so thrilled that she said, yeah, for sure. I would love to join you for an interview. So that's how this came to be. And I am really, really excited about this episode today.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer is so practical and granular with her advice. Mm-hmm. She really breaks down the technique for us. Now, Jennifer is a child and family therapist with over 20 years of experience, and she's a sought-after international speaker. She founded Connected Parenting, which you can find at connectedparenting.com, and she's also a host of a podcast by the same name, Connected Parenting, and co-host of the Mental Health Comedy Podcast. Mm-hmm. So without any further delay, let's get right to our conversation with Jennifer Colari.
Jennifer Colari, welcome to the Smart Family Podcast today. We're so glad you joined us for this episode as we talk more about parenting, in particular, connected parenting. When I read your work and read your book, I really read a lot of stories and I resonate with those stories because I say to myself, yep, I see those kids, I see those families in my office. My practice, I see them at my kids' schools. I see my own kids in those stories. And these are such real practical stories that you bring to life and relate how connected parenting can really make a difference. But before we dive into the technique of connected parenting, I'd love to just ask you, what do you see happening now in terms of challenges for parents, especially in light of COVID and what's happening in our world right now?
I mean, let's start with that because that's the obvious one. I mean, I'm really seeing it, families being strained. I work with parents and I also work with kids one-on-one. So younger kids, teens, young adolescents and young adults. And I would say across the board, kids are really struggling. They're having such a hard time. They are overwhelmed. They're anxious. They're missing out on so much. You know, even the kids who are at school, you've still got masks on and, you know, the kids that I work with say at school, but without the fun, right? And teacher, I worry about doctors, I worry about nurses, and I worry about teachers because they are having a hard time too. They are really stressed. And I think the kids are feeling that. I've talked to a bunch of teachers and administrators recently as the Toronto kids have gone back to school. And they're all saying, these are not the same kids that left. They're anxious, they're feral, they're running around, they can't focus. The kids on my caseload are saying, I can't focus at school. I used to be able to, but I can't. And I think they're so used to just looking at a screen, then looking at their phone, getting up, going to get a snack, playing video games while they're watching while they're watching classes, and they can't focus the same way. I'm sure it'll correct. I'm sure they'll get used to it again, but I'm seeing that. Parents are stressed, kids are fighting, they're all on top of each other. It's been really tough. And then I would say on top of that, parenting itself has really changed in the last, I would say, 25 to 30 years. We've sort of moved from a parent-centered model, which was certainly not all great, to a child-centered model, which I think is also not so great. We've kind of swung too far the other way. And I feel like kids, I was already seeing more anxiety, more depression, and more issues related to that. And I think parents love their kids so much and they want to do the right thing. And there's just so much mixed information out there about how to parent and what to do. And I always tell parents that, you know, connection and compassion is huge. And that's the medicine. That's probably the biggest part of connected parenting. But the equal other half to that is limit setting and consequences and predictable loving limits. And I tell parents, you're not actually parents. You're substitute frontal lobes. That's what you are, right? And your job is to inhibit and organize and prioritize and motivate and all of that stuff and take perspective. And I think that's where parents have been struggling and kids really push back. I think kids are getting sassier and smarter and feistier. And I think it's a challenge to really parent those kids into being the amazing human beings they're going to be, because we need kids who are going to bust the rules and bust paradigms and look at things in a different way. But you've got to be able to raise those kids so they can still function in groups and still follow the rules and so that they're not sort of left on the periphery of what they're really capable of. So they're pretty crazy times all around.
Yeah, I suppose in many ways it's the same world from generation to generation, but yet every generation is also so different, isn't it? And this generation, I mean, even just think about technology and our use of social media and how that has shaped the current generation.
Oh my goodness, I didn't even mention that. Like, that's just huge. That's having a huge, that alone, take COVID out, take the shift in parenting out, I think is having an enormous impact on mental health, for sure.
In your speaking and your writing, you give parents a lot of grace. And you recognize that there's no perfect parents. You know, the idea that a parent can doesn't have to be perfect, but can be good enough in parenting. What can you give us your thoughts on that idea?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's probably one of the things I'm the most proud of with this method and this model is it's really about embracing being perfectly imperfect. You know, and I say to parents, if you raised your children and you never got mad and you never showed any kind of negative emotion and you always had the right response and you did everything perfectly, you're going to mess them up anyway, because they're going to go out into the world and their boss is going to yell at them and somebody's going to, and they're going to go, what is happening here? So it's through the contrast and it's through the contours in life, the good and the bad, that children are learning to develop those emotional shock absorbers. And they're learning to kind of benefit from some healthy adversity. And that's so critically important to the brain. It is critically important to mental health. And so I really want parents to embrace, it's messy. It's going to be messy and it needs to be messy, or they're not going to know what on earth to do when they're on their own. Right. So I think that's a really important piece. And parents struggle a lot with that. And the other thing that I'm really big on is repair. So you blow it. What parent hasn't completely lost it? My own kids have said to me, you should read your own book. Honestly, of course I've lost it. You know, my husband has said, honey, you know, maybe you should mirror a little bit. I'm like, I got this, right? Like you lose it sometimes. It's really tough. And I say that parenting can take you to the highest of highs and the darkest parts of your soul. It really can. And so when you go back and you repair in a genuine and loving way, when you go back and you repair, sometimes that's as good, maybe even better than getting it right in the first place. And I think that's such freedom for parents.
Now, Jennifer, for most of us, when it comes to parenting, you know, we talk about that the days are long, but the years fly by. And many of us feel like we're still in the long days, that's for sure. One of the most important techniques you talk about is mirroring. And in fact, we're going to talk about calm in a second, and M stands for mirroring in that word calm. Can you explain to us what mirroring is and why you call this actually a therapy technique as opposed to just a parenting technique?
Yeah. So really mirroring itself is a therapy technique, and it was developed by Heinz Kohut many, many years ago. He founded self-psychology. I don't really know why the whole world doesn't know about it, because it's absolutely phenomenal. And he was way ahead of his time. The only thing I can think of is all the material written about it is so dense and so heavy and so complicated that you need a glass of water and a Tylenol to get through it, because it's not so easy to kind of absorb and understand, but it is beyond brilliant. So he came up with the concept of mirroring and attunement, which we'll get into in a second. And then I sort of took that, really studied it for many, many years, and realized how powerful it is. It's really medicine. Kind of developed my own way of doing it and my own way of breaking it down. So it's kind of my own brand of mirroring. Everyone does it a little bit differently. And this is the way that I teach it. And this is the way I practice it. And then realizing that as the neuroscience, you know, as we discover more about psychoneurobiology and neuroscience and the impact that all of these beautiful reward chemicals and biochemicals have on the brain, it's medicine. Mm-hmm. It is. So I teach parents basically how to deeply listen how to attune, how to put their own agenda aside just for a moment. I promise you that you get to bring it back. You have to, that's your job. But to have these deep moments of just beautiful, heart-centered, heart-coherent, actually listening. And when you do that, oxytocin and opiates and natural endorphins flood the brain, calming the person down. And by the way, it's a two-way street. So the person you're speaking to gets the benefits of that, but so do you as the speaker. And it actually brings you out of fight or flight and literally turns the frontal lobe back on so that you can respond instead of react. And it's kind of like having a superpower. Once you get this down, it's like a superpower. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to explain it.
Yeah. I mean, and we hear about some of these concepts as well, like with, you know, connect, then redirect, or connect and correct, mm-hmm. whatever. And then yep. even Ross Green, you know, in his problem solving approach talks about empathic listening, you know, and then that leads to sharing, you know, your concerns and then the child's concerns and or vice versa. And before your problem solves. Yes. So this is really so key to parenting, isn't it? No matter how you approach it.
It is. Well, it's key to being human, really.
Right.
I mean, I don't want people to think, oh, this is only for kids. You can use this on your mother-in-law. You can use it on your neighbors. You can use it on your spouse. It is counterintuitive. So you're never going to feel like using it. I'll be honest. It's something that you, even when you're really, really good at it, it's something that you need to be very mindful of because your limbic system will tell you to do the exact opposite. But once you do it enough times and you realize what you get back, it just deepens relationships. You're no longer afraid of conflict. There's a richness that happens to your relationships across the board. It's the gift that just keeps giving. It's not just for parenting. Mm-hmm. And it is different. So, I mean, Ross Green is phenomenal. I love his work and I often recommend his books and his approach to people. Active listening and empathic listening are different. So we'll make that distinction. Okay. The calm technique and mirroring is actually quite a different technique. So empathic listening or active listening is when you're using observational statements. So things like, I understand, you must feel, that must be really difficult for you, what I'm hearing. And it's a beautiful technique. There's nothing wrong with it. It's great. Mirroring is a little bit different. In mirroring, you use no observational statements, no it sounds like, no I must be's. The science behind it is that if you are using those techniques that require the language to just be turned around like that, it has to go through the language center first, and then it hits the limbic system. When you are mirroring, that's much closer to what an infant would get from a parent or caregiver. And we'll break this down for everyone, but there's no observational statements, which means it's basically affect driven. It's affect based. It is based on intention as well. So if your intention is to deeply, deeply understand and listen, not to calm the person down, not to get the person to settle down so you can fix the problem, not to get the child to behave so you can get them into bed, but truly suspend time and exist only in that moment with that child or that person. And then when you do that, it's bypassing the language center and hitting the limbic system directly. And that's where the oxytocin just flows through the body. And when you get this immediate, like, oh, it's like the air being let out of it. It's like the kids freaking out. They're like, oh, you can see it physically. Mm-hmm. Whoever you're doing this with, you can see it instantly. And it's quite lovely, actually. So it's quite a unique technique.
So let's get into the technique then, Jennifer. Sure. I love the acronym for it because it's just so, it seems to be so like consistent with what it is you're talking about. So it's CALM, mm-hmm. the CALM technique. Can you break that mm-hmm. down for us?
I can, absolutely. So there's four things that you're going to do whenever you are trying to deeply listen to another human. The first letter, C, is for, that's for connect. You also want to calm yourself a little bit. So there are these little techniques that you can do. If you just drop your tongue on the bottom of your teeth, just let your tongue go soft for a second. Can you feel how your stomach lets go?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
your stomach relaxes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just relaxes. So the minute we're upset or we're uptight or the brain senses danger, the limbic system, which is the part of the brain that's the security system in the brain. When you relax your tongue and your stomach relaxes, it sends a signal to the brain that you're no longer in danger. If we think something's about to attack us and jump at us, what's the first thing we do? We tighten up all of our core muscles. We tighten up our lungs. We tighten up our jaw, and we get ready to fight back or run or freeze, one of those three things. And when you just relax your tongue just a little bit in the bottom of your teeth, your stomach will let go and it sends an instant signal to your brain. Oh, well, there must be nothing that's going to attack me. I maybe have a few minutes to think about what I'm going to do. Such a simple thing. Change your breathing, relax your shoulders. So you just take a second to just bring yourself into a moment of kind of being as calm as you can. Remember, if you blow this, because you will, because we all do, you can go back and use the technique to repair. So that's C. You're also going to take your agenda here, which is, I can't believe we're doing this again, and you've got to get to bed, and what do you mean you didn't do your homework, and how dare you speak to me like that? We're going to just park it. I promise you, it comes back. It needs to come back, but this is the part where you just put it aside. A is for the affect matching. So this is where the look on your face really needs to match to some degree the look on their face. So the example I usually give is, I don't know, let's say you have a little five-year-old and he comes to you and says, you know, I thought Jillian loves me, but Jillian loves Josh. And you smile, right? Because that's cute. That's so cute for a five-year-old. But that look on my face does not match with that little guy's feeling. His little heart is broken. He's feeling upset. He thought he loved Jillian and that she loved him. So you really have to make sure that your face is matching the look on their face. And that's true with anger. It's true with fear. It's true with whatever your child or the person you're speaking to is experiencing, which means you have to be really careful because your own emotions can really kind of mess this up. So you want to make sure that the affect matches. It can't be exact because that's weird. Mm-hmm. And you got to be natural. You have to be normal. Yep. And then at this point, you're on to the words. So I love how this actually falls because if what you say is so much less important than how you say it, honestly, it really is. You can say so much with just your face. And I know this is audio, but you know, you can just lean forward and kind of really have a look on your face. Like, I want to understand this and like what, and that's it. That's sometimes you don't say anything. You just do that with your body. And then your child goes, oh, Daddy's really trying to get me here. Mommy's really trying to understand me here. And you're halfway there, right? Yeah. So the language of the listening part, you can summarize what the child just said. You can clarify what the child just said. You can paraphrase what the child just said. And all of those things need to be done with the right affect on your face. So usually I'll give an example, and I probably give this one all the time, but it's a really good one. I don't know, your child's drawing something or they're building something, falls apart, they start screaming. Our first response is usually, oh, are you kidding me? Can I not get 5 seconds peace in this house? Right. Yep. So that's where you drop your tongue and you breathe and you look at baby pictures on the wall and you do whatever you can to kind of bring yourself into a place where you can respond instead of react. And as you're walking up the stairs to deal with that situation, you're trying to do that first. But usually what happens is we come charging up the stairs. What is it? What is it? What is it now? Ah, this Lego tower is falling apart. It's so stupid. And fire the people at Lego. I hate them, mommy. And nothing ever goes the way I want it to. And blah, blah, blah. And usually as a parent, we're carrying our own stuff. We've got our own whatever happened that day, plus our own successes and failures, our own trauma, maybe our own childhood stuff. Parenting is an inside job. It really is, right? So you can get triggered very easily if you're exhausted, if this child is particularly triggering to you. And in those moments, you'll start reacting to your child. Now, most people will walk upstairs and do that. What is it? What's the matter? And then the kid says, the people at Lego are fine. Stop it. You don't know anything about the people at Lego. You need to calm down. You know, if you can't handle these toys, we're just going to put them away don't you take my toys. I hate you. And round we go. Or as a parent, we often come upstairs in cheerleader fix it mode. What's the matter, honey? What's the matter? What can I do? Look at this tower. It's falling apart. The people at Lego are stupid. Nothing ever works. Well, honey, calm down. Calm down. We can do this together. Let's find the book. I didn't use a book. Okay, well, that's okay. You know what? Sometimes things turn out better when this happens. Does any of that sound like anything you would want to hear if you were upset?
No.
Yeah. No. Right? You were just working on a presentation, or let's say, God forbid, we'll make sure we're recording. You recorded the most awesome podcast ever. And you realize at the end, after 45 minutes, you didn't hit record. Yeah. Right? And somebody goes, oh, well, you know what? These things happen and life's full of these ups and downs. And you never know. The first one could be better. None of that is what we want to hear in that moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe after we've calmed down, after we're not in fight or flight, right? Maybe then. And usually the person will give you an indication of when they're ready to move on to a stage when they're ready to look at it differently and or learn from it or fix it or whatever else. So what I teach parents to do is to follow the calm techniques. You're going to collect yourself and you're going to go up the stairs. You're going to do your breathing. your child's going to say, I hate my life and these Lego pieces are stupid and all the people at Lego should be fired. And now I'm going to use my language. So I'm showing the child on my face, like I am not in there ready to go, what now? I'm in there to go, baby, what happened? You were working so hard on this. When I walked by a few minutes ago, your tower was this high. What happened? Can you hear my affect? So it's all about the urgency. It's about reflecting the urgency back, right?
Right.
And then I can paraphrase. So you're having a hard time figuring out how this is somebody's job to create this toy, this thing, and it doesn't work. And you've tried it a bunch of times, right? I can summarize. You know what? I think this happened last week when you were building the spaceship. Didn't the same thing happen? Hear my affect, right? I can wonder out loud. I can say, oh, this sucks. And you worked so hard on this too. And you put so much energy into it. It was amazing. And then on top of that, you didn't get invited to that party yesterday. And I'm wondering if that's also part of what's happening here. So you connect it back with the wondering. And the one that's actually the most important is clarifying. And this is really good for kids who are highly sensitive. This is really important for kids who are gifted, kids who have ADHD, any kids who are on the spectrum. If you come in reflecting the emotion right back to children like that, they will often be like, stop it, stop it, stop saying that. Because they can't actually, they don't actually want to see the emotion being reflected back, but they do want the urgency reflected back. So with clarifying, it's like, tell me what happened here. Like, when did this start falling apart? What piece do you think, where do you think the people at Lego are blowing it? Like, so you're actually picking a non-emotional but important detail out. And then, oh, I'll tell you, this is when it started. And you'll start to have a conversation, right? So I would say there are those groups, gifted kids for sure, and highly sensitive kids will sometimes not de-escalate right away from the mirroring. But honestly, if you're doing it right, it works about 85 to 95% of the time. Within 3 or 4 statements, you will have a complete de-escalation and a chemical de-escalation. And then what you often get is tears. Mm. You just get some crying and then you have a big hug and then you have a little snuggle.
Yeah.
And then you're ready to learn.
And it sounds like what you're really communicating is that A, you're interested in what your child's doing, and you're being intentional about finding that out. It validates what they are expressing in that moment of, you know, childlike disaster.
Yep.
And that you want to understand, you know, when you ask clarifying questions and you paraphrase, like you really, I mean, it just emotes caring, I think. And that's, I think, what our kids want to hear. And my tendency is always to want to try and fix things right away. I mean, for some reason, and then maybe that's a guy thing, I don't know, but my wife always reminds me, like, I don't want you to fix it. I just want you to listen and to understand and try to see what I'm feeling. But when do we move to that? Because, you know, it's nice to do the calming and attunement and listening and mirroring and stuff. But at some point, we do want to address some of the difficulties that our child is facing. We want to teach them something. I mean, discipline is all about teaching. You know, that's what it really means. So when do we move from that, okay, I'm mirroring, I understand, and we're in good space now, to like, okay, but like, what's next? How do we redirect? How do we correct?
So that's an excellent, excellent question. And I always say that's my thing, right? Connect before correct. And this is part of the connection. So after, it's usually honestly about 3 or 4 statements. If you do this well and your agenda is aside and you really have a successful, you know, kind of mirroring interaction, it'll be 3 or 4 statements. And the child will then, or the person will then give you an indication that they're ready. Well, what should I do? What would you do if this was me? Did this happen to you when you're a little kid? Maybe I'm just hungry and I'll go eat. Like all anybody needs is to be heard. That's it. They just want to be heard. And once they've been heard, it's over with. They don't need to keep saying it over and over and over again because you've actually heard them. And this is why I say to parents, when you come in and you get into these loops with your kids and they say things like, I hate my life and nothing ever works for me. And you're like, but honey, look how much you have. And think about all the happy things in your life. And you have a family and there's people in COVID going through so much worse. And that only makes kids feel guilty that now they feel terrible for what they have. And it ends up being this vortex, right? This situation where they just constantly feel invalidated. And we feel like, well, maybe this is what I need to pull them out of it. I need to like get them out of this, right? But actually they get themselves out of it. and they get themselves out of it when they've been heard. So just think of it like a message. They've sent a message and you're hitting it back, sent, right? Received, right? That's what happens in the de-escalation part. Once they've heard you, it's like, that's why I said it's like a balloon that pops. They're just like, oh, okay. That's why it feels like a superpower. Because so often they'll just move on, right? So it's usually three or four statements and look for a clue, look for a cue. They'll ask you a question. They'll ask something that happened to you. They'll ask for, oh, well, what do you think, Dad? Do you think we could start again? Or they'll want a snack, or they'll just forget it. Half the time they're like, okay. And they walk out of the room and you're like, what just happened here? We went from like a huge meltdown to like, okay. And it happens all the time. And try it out on people. Try it on people in your work. Mm-hmm. It's seriously a superpower. Once people realize, oh, okay, they heard me. It's over. Yeah. So, and there's sort of three steps. There's the mirroring, and then there's present the problem, and then there's coming, and then coming up with a solution. So once you've done the mirroring part, now you can present the problem. So the problem is, we got all this Lego on the floor now. What can we do, right? Or how can we learn from this? Or can this be a learning lesson? Or can we clean it up together or whatever it is? And then the solution is, what can we learn from it? What can we do differently next time? Right? And you just sort of apply those three things to every situation.
Do you ever find that you have questions from parents about, you know, using this technique as children are growing up? You know, it may work wonderfully in your relationship and in your home, but then once kids launch and enter the real world, you know, the world of rewards and consequences, you know, that maybe they're not quite mm-hmm. prepared for what they're going to face. Like, do people ever ask you that?
That's a really good question. They do. I get asked that all the time. And I might even be asked it in a more direct way. Like, if I do this for my kids all the time, aren't they going to fall apart when the rest of the world does it? Here's the answer. Because you do this to your child, they don't need the rest of the world to do it. And that's the truth. It builds them up from the inside out. And there's tons of research now that demonstrates how connection and close relationships build resilience. It is actually the antidote mm-hmm. to addiction, if you want to come right down to it. So over and over again, what happens is they get enough from you because you're the parent. They feel heard. They feel seen, that it's consistently happening. Neural pathways are building in the brain where they feel like they have a voice in their family. And don't forget the other half of connected parenting, which we'll get to, is limit setting, right? And consequences. That's a very important part of being a parent. You are a frontal lobe. But the truth is, they develop this thicker skin. And when you send them out into the world, they don't get as affected. I'll tell you a really interesting story. And I have a bunch of them, but one family comes to mind where, and they were the loveliest people. This is years ago. Both parents were accountants, very left-brained. And they were honest. They were like, I didn't even talk to my kids when they were babies. Like, I didn't do that. So how am I going to do this? And so once I explained the science and why it really works, and it's quite prescriptive what I help parents do. Like, it is really a very prescriptive way to learn. Once you've got it, then you sort of, you're the artist. Anyway, their son was he on the spectrum? No, I think he was just super gifted and was running the house. This kid wouldn't get out of his pajamas. They couldn't get him. This is way before COVID. This is 10 years ago. He wouldn't do anything they wanted him to do. They could barely get him to school. He was aggressive. He was violent. He was physically aggressive with both parents and his brother. He was still, he was encopredic. He was being he was a mess, this kid. Brilliant, brilliant child, but not functioning very well. And his parents loved him desperately, tried everything else, medication. He'd been around the rainbow route that I call it. And he finally came to us. And the parents were like, okay, this seems weird and it seems really hard, but we've heard really good things, so we're going to do it. So they started, you know, doing the mirroring with this child and conversational and what I call chit-chat mirroring is actually a really big part of it. That's where you do this technique just in conversation. You don't wait for your child to be, I don't want people to go, oh, I can't wait for my kid to be upset so I can use this. You actually use it all the time. And as you're doing this, you are building emotional resilience. You are strengthening the child from the inside out. They are developing an improved emotional regulation, right? So this is what's happening to this kid. We didn't even have to get to the limit setting too much, which is actually what happens often. And we'd been at it a few months and the kid was starting to get dressed and flexing through his life and just doing more things. And the biggest thing I tell parents is when the child starts doing these things, don't say, oh, look at you dressed on a Saturday morning at 10. Don't do that. You're going to send them right back to their pajamas. just normal. It's all just normal. Great. You're good. Glad you're here. Like this very kind of casual thing. Anyway, they ended up at a family reunion, which typically either he wouldn't, I think, hadn't gone to for the last few years. But anyway, when he did go, it was a disaster. There were meltdowns and screaming and they left early and they had to take two cars. It was always a nightmare. Anyway, this whole family picnic is going quite well and the family is playing baseball. Now, as often happens with families, there is often a sibling who is overfunctioning, right? Doing really well, straight A's, lots of friends, behaves nicely. And we'll get to that in a second because we're going to be shifting family dynamics here. But that was the case. His little brother was just a super achiever. The kid is actually playing baseball with the family at the family reunion, which is astonishing to begin with. The parents are already celebrating that. And then he actually winds up and hits this ball. And it is unbelievable. It's going to be a home run. And everybody's excited for this kid. And it's wonderful. And doesn't the little brother zoom in at the last second and make this incredible catch? And this kid is out. Now, the parents said they just froze. They got ready. They stiffened up. The whole family did. All the extended family were like, oh, boy. And this is what happened. This kid said, good catch. Oh. And the family burst into tears. The parents and the grandparents both. They were like, what? What is happening? And that's what I hear over and over. I mean, in the beginning, when I was developing this methodology and bringing it to families, I would have pediatricians call and say, who are you? What are you doing? Like, why are we seeing these kids who we were quite sure were oppositional defiant disorder and completely out of control, turning it around? Now, that doesn't mean those things don't exist. Of course they do. And connected parenting will help. But often it is just behavior. And so the measure that I use is if a family comes to me and their child, which is most common actually, is perfect at school. Lovely at school, lovely at daycare, lovely at friends' houses, perfectly behaved everywhere, and they're an absolute nightmare at home. That's how I know that it's behavior. That's how I know that it's fixable. And that's how I know that it's parenting. Good news is it's parenting. Bad news is it's parenting. But they're often what I call gladiators. So these are kids who are sassy and spicy and smart. And they were born saying, why should I? That's not fair. I don't have to do what you tell me. They are the children, I believe, that are going to save us all, but they are really, really difficult to parent. They get a bad rap. There is all kinds of negative pathology with kids like that. And I don't use that at connected parenting. That's why I use words like spicy and gladiator. Like, you've got a kid like that, let's celebrate that, because they're going to be someone who actually starts to change things for us. But they're really, really difficult to parent. And then if there's a child who's having difficulty everywhere, then it's more likely that it's something neurological. Then we become part of the multidisciplinary team and we help and work with everyone.
Let's talk about limit setting for a minute, because you mentioned it a few times. And, you know, I think it's tempting sometimes as parents for us to sometimes to solve problems like by being nice to our kids and doing everything for them. And you actually talk about being kind versus being nice. Yes. I want you to talk about that. And also just walking on eggshells sometimes just to not upset the apple cart. Like, let's just not cause any problems here. So anyways, can you just talk about like why it's still important to set limits? Like, we're not talking about permissive parenting and just letting our kids just kind of walk all over us and do whatever they want. Like, there is still a role for limits.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Not only is there a role for it, it's critical to good mental health. It truly, truly is. So let me back up. I usually go broad and then I get more precise. But the biggest thing that I want parents to understand is with that parenting shift that I was talking about, where we've gone from this parent-centered model to a child-centered model, which has really been, I think, the last 20 to 25 years. And it came from a lot of different sources. There were, and all well-meaning, but for a while there were a lot of parenting messages that timeouts are bad and saying no is bad. And, you know, you'll ruin your child's self-esteem. They need to have a say in everything. They need to be part of family discussions. And there's truth to that within a certain framework, right? But a four-year-old doesn't want to have control. He doesn't want to have a say in whether you get that car or you move. Like, there are certain things that even kids will tell you that. They're like, what are you nuts? I'm five. Why would you ask me? Like, they're smart. They know, right? So we want them to have what's called perceived choice about certain things. We don't want them to feel like their every single thing is controlled. But There are huge things that kids need to know that the parent is in charge. And so when we had this parenting swing, and I do not think it's a coincidence, one day I'll prove it, that we started seeing such a spike in anxiety, issues with emotional regulation, executive functioning. Why? Because the parent's job is to provide that executive functioning until that brain is developed enough on its own. And parents kind of stopped doing that. They did it out of love. They did it because they thought it was the right thing. But you started to see a huge increase in behavior and emotional regulation issues. So the example that I give, and I can't think of a better one, is imagine that you're on an airplane and it is a bumpy, terrifying, horrifying flight. And the captain decides he's going to wander down the aisle and check on everybody. And he can barely stand up. And he's like, hey, guys, like, what do you think? I could do 28,000 feet. I could try to go into 30,000 feet. Maybe I could try going around the storm. Honestly, what would you guys say to that captain?
Just do it.
You nuts. Fly the plane. Are you crazy? I'm a and how would you feel? Absolutely petrified, right? That nobody's flying that plane. Like, beyond terrified. So I always say, we want Captain Sully. Remember Captain Sully? The guy who landed that plane in the Hudson River? Stayed calm the whole time. We want someone calm, unflappable, firm, and in charge. So their children sense love also with loving limits. And children know the difference between being nice and being kind. Being nice is actually toxic. Right? It's not good for anyone. It doesn't teach anyone anything. And you're usually being nice when you're kind of ripping yourself off and just saying it so that you don't have a conflict or you don't, you know, get challenged or you don't end up, whatever, upsetting the person. Kindness means being very, very centered and aligned with love, right? And when you're, and sometimes being kind is no, you can't have another cookie. And I love you enough for you to be mad at me, you're going to bed. Because 8-year-olds need 11 and a half hours of sleep. That's why, right? And you don't have to be nasty and you don't have to yell and you don't have to scream, you don't have to take things away. And when you have that firm, centered, grounded approach that is grounded in fear, in love, not fear, children know and they respond and they don't even argue with you. They're like, okay. Like they just sense that your authority, right? In a very loving way. And so what happens often with parents is they line up with fear. They're either afraid their kid's going to blow up or have a fit, or they're going to upset them, or they're going to hurt their feelings, and you've got to line up with love.
Yeah. Now you just mentioned something there in your answer there about Captain Sully staying calm and collected, and I think we can all, see the importance of that. But how do you jive that with mirroring your child's emotions, when you're going through calm with them? How do you do both of those things at the same time when you're trying to mirror how your child's doing, you're trying to affect match and yet stay calm and neutral?
Yep. So you separate them, right? The first part, that's why I say, take your agenda and put it over here. There's no teaching moment in that. There's no, what do we do? There's no problem solving. There's no, what are we learning from this? That comes after. And that comes after you've chemically calmed that person down. You're really dealing with that psychoneurobiology, right? So in that moment, it is truly genuine. Your intention only, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with what they're feeling, is that you want to deeply understand and be present where they are and get all those emotional matches going, all those beautiful reward chemicals going. And just to let you know, when oxytocin is flowing, it actually speeds up neuroplasticity. It'll make your kid smarter. It strengthens the immune system. What could be more important than that in the middle of a pandemic? It's a cortisol blocker. It blocks cortisol powerfully, actually. It's a stress hormone. And that's the cortisol is what gives us that butterfly feeling. And it's what makes us stay up at night. And that pit in your stomach that you have sometimes as a parent when you're worried about your child or what your child is feeling when they're going off to school after being home on lockdown. And those are huge things. And it's free. And you don't need a prescription for it. And there's no negative side effects. And you get the bounce back, right? So you get all those benefits too. So forget for a second that this is amazing for your child. How about this is amazing for you, right? As you move through your day and try to be a parent and then work and do podcasts and manage the bills and everything else. So the more oxytocin is flowing in your home, the happier and the more emotionally organized everyone is, not just your child. So the first step is you really have to do what I said. Then you'll know, because your child or whoever you're talking to will give you an indication they're ready to move on to the next part. And then that's where you set the limits. And that's where you say, sweetheart, I love you enough for you to be mad at me, but you are going to go and have a sit for a few minutes. You hit your brother, or you are going to go to bed early for early to bed, or you are, I'm going to take the iPad away at this moment because you're not showing good judgment. That's where those limits come in. And it's really important that consequences are fair and reasonable and front-loaded. I'm really big on front-loading. You don't come in, no matter how beautifully you do it, and say, okay, guys, you know, I love you enough for you to be mad at me, but all iPads gone. Everybody's out of control. So for the next week, nobody's having an iPad. No, you would say to your kids, look, mirroring first, right? There's so many amazing games on there. And that's where you communicate with your friends. I totally get all that. But I'm a little bit worried that you're not making good decisions around how much time you're spending on this thing. So I'm going to give you a few days to show me that you can regulate yourself. Let's see how you do. Kids love that, especially teenagers. Let's see how you do. And if after a few days, whatever you've agreed upon is up and they're still drooling and on their iPad, they're not doing anything, then you say, you know what? I love you enough for you to be mad at me, but you're telling me with words that you don't need my help, but you're showing me with behavior that you absolutely do need my help. And I love you enough to be a good parent here. And that's a really interesting thing, because kids hear that and they know it, first of all. And they also know, if you know what's right and you don't do it, you're too scared to do it, or you're too worried to do it, or you're too tired to do it, they're not going to respect that. And you're then lined up with fear, not love. Right. The other dynamic, and this is, and Tony, this is a really important one, is that parents often polarize. So one is usually way more comfortable with consequences. This is ridiculous. These kids are out of control. We got to do something. That's it. All electronics gone. Right. And then the other parent is usually, this is quite a common dynamic, is the exact polar opposite of that. So they're like, oh, it's not his fault. He's tired. He's hungry. He's this, he's that, she's this, she's that, right? And they're all about compassion and looking at, you know, what's going on behind the behavior. And I love that, because behavior is never the problem. It's the symptom of the problem, but it's never the problem. And so what happens is those two parents start compensating for what they believe is a weakness in the other one's parenting. So the tougher one has to get tougher and the softer one has to get softer. And now the kids, who are very clever, usually figure that out pretty fast. They can split the whole situation, get their two parents fighting, sneak out the back door, and, you know, not, and avoid all the trouble, right? So this is why there's two sides to connected parenting. And when I work with parents together, it's why both sides are so valued. And parents need to understand, you don't have to compensate for each other. You complement each other. Don't try to turn the other one into you. Would you want two people like you in your marriage? No. Right? You want someone who naturally complements you, and together you're like this amazing team, right? But parents often get so wound up in that. And that's how tons of marriages break down, actually, especially if you have challenging kids. That and money will do it. And then when I have families coming to me and they're fighting and they're struggling and they're thinking about separating, I'm like, you better get your act together. You've got to communicate. You've got to complement each other. You've got to be best friends. Otherwise, divorce, ugly, expensive, nasty. And it's not divorce that damages the children. It's how the parents talk about each other and handle each other in front of the children that causes the damage. So whether you're staying together, whether you're separated or together, it's really important to get your act together with this stuff and be a united front. And that also calms kids down and helps kids to feel grounded and safe and loved. And that's why the two parts are really important.
You mentioned challenging kids. And I would imagine sometimes you work with a parent whose kid is challenging to the point where, you know, they are questioning whether they even like their kid anymore. And I'm wondering how do you help a parent like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that's a really common dynamic. So I have so many moms and dads. I would say it's even more moms that come into my office and say two things. They say, I'm the worst parent in the world. I'm the worst mother in the world. And first of all, you're not, or you wouldn't say that. The worst parent in the world would not say that. And the second is, I love my child, but I hate him. Right? And there's such guilt. There's such a heaviness there, because you're not supposed to feel that way. And even the most empathic, loving parent, when you have a child that is such a gladiator, that is pushing all the rules, wrecking everything, aggressive with your other children, always, always causing problems and always arguing, you are human. You're going to get to a place where that kid comes in the room and you're like, oh, great. Hi, honey. How are you? And you're like gritting your teeth, like, what now? Right? And so what happens is that child who is also very anxious, feeling that kind of anxious attachment, not because you haven't loved them. This is so human. Like, we've all been there with our kids. If you have a gladiator, you've been there. But that child starts to feel anxious. And instead of saying, oh, you know, I think I've really upset mom. I think dad doesn't love me. You know, I'm going to be my best self. I'm going to really try. No, they do the exact opposite. If mommy and daddy aren't going to love me, then I'm going to know why. And so I'm going to control how horrible I am so I can remind myself that they don't love me because I'm choosing these behaviors. It's not quite that conscious, but that's really what happens. And so the number of things that I do with families around retelling that story, right? So baby play and limbic bonding is a huge part of that, where I literally prescribe, depending on the situation with the child, it could be up to 15 or 20 minutes a day of literally rubbing noses, you know, tickling, baby play. And that's medicine. That is huge. Absolutely huge. And I don't ever work with a family and change any behaviors and bring in containment until I'm pretty sure that the connection has been restored. Because if you try to do the containment when the connection is strained, and please don't hear that. I want people to hear, it's not that they don't love their kids. It's this, the child has just bashed at you and kept at you and at you and at you until you can't even see straight anymore. Right. And so when the connection is strong, now consequences can come in and they can be experienced as limits. They can be experienced as discipline, which means to teach. Right. But when you're so frustrated and you're so angry and you're screaming and you're yelling, then it's experienced as an injury. And consequences will never work that way. Never. If they come from a place of anger or fear, they will never work. And these kids are what I call consequence resistant. They get to the point where, like, yeah, I don't care. Take it away. It doesn't matter. You take it away. I'll go find your car keys. I'll take your car keys. Like, they just keep going back and forth and back and forth. And so the bond must be restored. So I do a lot of that I do a lot of work with the family first and a lot of mirroring to them, right? I want to give them a really safe and loving space where they can kind of forgive themselves, right? And align back up with love and maybe even deal with some stuff that's brought up for them from childhood and from other issues. And teach them how to self-parent. And then we get into the baby play, right? So that's the limbic bonding where it's like, and it's so wonderful to watch. Like, cause I'll have families that are like, really? How many minutes a day do I have to do it? And I'm like, and I always say the child you least feel like doing this with is the child that needs it the most. If your first instinct is, dear God, I don't want to do that, you got to dig deep. And parents do. They dig deep. And in the beginning, I'll say, you know what? Maybe in the beginning, it's an Academy Award performance. Okay. But you do it. And if the child doesn't really want it, then you bring out a little stuffy and you go, look at this. This was your stuffy when you were little, and show them pictures and tell them stories about when they were little. And I have families build what's called an accomplishment book where the parents sort of catch them being good. And they read that every night at bedtime. And I've actually had parents, we've literally done a redo. We've gone back, way back, right from the beginning and redone things through play. And it's been really quite powerful. And the parent heals too at the same time, right? And then it gets easier and easier to parent from a place of love, not fear.
If it's a teenager that the parent's working with, how does the baby play look in that case?
Okay, I'll tell you a funny story about this. So that's a really good question. And the truth is, teenagers are funny. They really do want this and crave this. They will act like they don't. My theory on teenagers and how they behave, and I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. I'll prove this too one day. But I think it has to do with the fact that there's no such thing as adolescence. It's a Western phenomenon, right? It's in most cultures in the world, you're a kid and then you're an apprentice adult and then you're an adult. And it's very, very clear, right? In our culture, you're a kid and then you're a kid like right on through to almost 30 sometimes. So, and if you look, if you go back 100 years, kids primarily went to school till about middle school. And then boys would apprentice with their uncles and their fathers and the men, and they would want to prove that they're a man, and they'd look what I can do, like how strong I am. That's gone. You don't hear that. Girls would have, I think it was called a trousseau, where they had a little chest with everything in it that they were going to have when they were an adult, and they wanted to prove that they fit in with the adult women in the community. And there was this sense of hierarchy, which, by the way, mirrors the brain, frontal lobe, midbrain, right? And then around adolescence, you wanted to be accepted by the adult community. So you still had all those frontal lobes around you, right? And that's where you belonged, and that's how you were kept safe. And then, and I'm not saying high school's bad, of course you got to go to high school, but, you know, many, many years ago, what shifted is high school. And so there's, you know, a bunch of kids, one adult, and that adult switches every hour. And other than some coaches and stuff, you're kind of losing that adult community surrounding you that you're trying to fit into and belong to. And so what happens is you get this almost attachment behavior. It's like, you don't love me, fine. And there's a lot of slamming doors and leave me alone and you're embarrassing and get out of my room and all of that. And we've been sort of sold this idea, oh, that's normal. Just accept that. That's okay. You know, it'll end. And to a certain degree, there is a lot of truth in that. But what causes all those issues is those teenagers miss the connection with you. I'm a therapist. I have teenagers in my office every single day. And yes, they're talking about peer stuff and social media and school. But you know what they're talking about 95% of the time? Mm-hmm. Their parents. That's who they're talking about. My dad doesn't love me. My mom loves my brother better. That's what they're talking about, right? They're craving that connection. They have no idea how to get it. So a really interesting story that I love to tell, and you guys have probably heard this one, but it's my favorite. I had a family. I was a two-day workshop, actually, that I was doing at a school, actually, and it was for a group of teachers. And one of the teachers said to me, a similar question to yours, but with a little bit of an edge to it. She said, my kid's a goth. Okay, if I do this with my kid, he's going to puke on me. Like, there's no way that my kid is going to want this. And I have done this for so long, and I have seen this so many times. And I knew already right away, just the way she was talking about him, that they were very far apart. The connection was quite threadbare. Let's put it that way. Not that this mom didn't love this child, but, and I said, look, what do you got to lose at this point? Just go home and try it. Just do it. Just see what happens. So she comes home, and normally, you know, he wouldn't have unloaded the dishwasher. He hadn't done his homework. He's playing video games and screaming. They get so loud, teenage boys. You're cheap, and they're swearing at each other, and like, oh, it's like pollution, noise pollution in the house. I think he had his boots on, his Doc Martens on. He's a goth, so he's got the whole getup on. And she comes home, and she would normally scream at him, "What are you doing? And why haven't you done the dishwasher? And turn that down!" And that would be what. And he'd shut up. I hate you. And that's kind of how the night would go. And she went home, and she tried this, and she said, "You know what? I don't care if you're a goth, you're the cutest goth in the whole wide world." And she started tickling him. And for a second, he was like, he went with it. And then they were both like, what are we doing? That's weird. And she literally didn't even do it for that long. And then she said for the rest of the night, they went on to have one of the best nights they'd had in a very, very long time. And this is my favorite part of the story. She long stopped saying goodnight to him, long stopped tucking him in, like that was long gone. And she's walking past his room. I don't know what time it was, about 11 o'clock at night or something. And she hears, "Mommy, will you come tuck me in?" She could not believe what she was hearing. She walked into his room. She tucked him in. They rubbed noses for a second. She was holding her breath because she could not believe that this was happening. Left the room, closed the door, slid down the wall, and burst into tears. And that was the beginning of a very big change for that mom and that son, right? When I tell you this is powerful, I'm not kidding. Like, it's the most powerful medicine on earth. And it is what each one of us crave and need.
Yeah. Wow.
Jennifer, it's obvious that you're passionate about what you're talking about. And it just comes through in the many, many stories, and such powerful stories too. I mean, you've just described parents and children who really seem poles apart, who are able to get connected. And I think that's the goal of connected parenting and connected relationships, really. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Jennifer, can you point us to some resources where parents might go to find out more about this and more about you and the work you do and to learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we have a practice. So we've got a number of therapists that are trained in the connected parenting model. And I have a number of really great therapists right now that are all MSWs. I think they're all MSWs who are going through the program as well. So we've got a number of people who are trained in this. So that's, we have an office in Toronto and in San Diego, but we see people from all over the world. Our clients are from all over the world. There's my books, which you can find on the website. There's two books. There's You're Ruining My Life, which is a teenage book. And then there's How to Raise a Great Kid, which is the one that's kind of up to 13. There's my podcast. So I do a weekly podcast talking about all of these issues and trying to tackle some of the current things that are going on in the world. I have another podcast called the Mental Health Comedy Podcast, which is I record that with a friend of mine, Ed Krasnick, who's a comedian. And we interview well-known comedians and entertainers. We've had Howie Mandel on the show. We've had Judd Apatow on the show. Lots of great people. And we talk about mental health and we talk about the struggles that these entertainers have and what to do about it. So that practice is really, that's really neat because we talk about strategies, skills. You walk away with a skill every time you listen to that episode. I have my parenting course. So this is a great option for families who can't necessarily afford individual therapy or don't have insurance. And it's hours and hours of instruction. There's two types. There's me and just the videos. And I take you through the entire curriculum. So what a lot of people do is they can't afford too many sessions. They'll watch the course and then they'll book a couple of sessions to just kind of tweak things with their child. And that's the just straight video. And then we have another one where I'm available once a month for coaching calls. And then in a closed Facebook group, I'm interacting with everybody and answering their parenting questions and people are helping each other. And that's really an amazing community. That's a lot of fun. We also have something called Role Playing Playground, which is it's a monthly thing. Actually, no, it's once a week. It's Fridays, I think, right now. And people go in and they practice. They practice the calm technique and they have a lot of fun and they support each other and they help each other and they laugh. And it's an incredible community. And that's a lot of fun. So we've tried to create something for everyone so that we can get this message out because it really does, it really helps. And any family who is feeling stressed about their child and really suffering, and when the family is disconnected like that, everyone's in pain. Everyone is in pain. And it's time to help families kind of have practical, usable, magical tools that can change that.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Hey, wasn't that a great conversation today with Jennifer Kalari about connected parenting? I mean, we talk on the Smart Family Podcast all the time about how you can boost your parenting to the next level, about building relationships that last, and just using the techniques that Jennifer describes, I think will definitely get you to the next level and really improve the relationships that you have within your family, whether it's with your kids or with your spouse. Man, even if it's with relationships with friends or with people that you work with, being able to connect and communicate in this way is really going to be powerful in every facet of your life. So great to hear Jennifer today, and thanks for joining us for this. Hey, if you want to find out more about the Smart Family Podcast, you can definitely find us on our website, smartfamilypodcast.com. And also on Instagram and on Facebook at Smart Family Podcast. Leave a message there. And hey, if you get an opportunity to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, we would just so appreciate it. It just feeds back information to us about what you like about the show and how we can make it better. So just, yeah, please do communicate with us through any of those channels. We would so appreciate that very much. And if you want the podcast to land into your feed automatically, just subscribe to the podcast and you'll see every new episode there. And plus, of course, access the library of episodes that we have there now with people we mentioned today in the podcast. So we talked about Ross Green and we talked about Mona Delahook, Barry Prezant, Russell Barkley on ADHD. So many great guests we've had so far, each of them bringing so much great information to us as parents and as partners, and how we can really improve the relationships within our family. So thanks again for listening to the Smart Family Podcast, where it is our aim to help you love being home. I'm your co-host, Dr. Rob Meter. See you next time.